I want to begin by reading a brief article written by a lady. I have been married to a critical spouse for 14 years. Very little I do or say suits him, and I no longer look for his approval. This man can justify everything he says. It's my fault he gets so angry he can't help it. I've learned to block him out and do the best I can. If he's not pleased, that's his problem. I've learned to build my own happiness through hobbies that I enjoy in loving the Lord, His Word, beautiful Christian music. God is very precious, for I know He loves and accepts me, even if my husband does not. I cannot forgive my husband, but I ask God to forgive. I used to contemplate suicide, but I've come to realize I'm not as bad as he says, and life is good. Engaged couples should be advised. It is far better to be alone than to be married to a critical man or woman. Love can be blind. I know. For some time, we have been looking at a brief series on marriage. This morning we come to session number 3. And I want us to take a look at marriage as found in the Old Testament book called the Song of Solomon. And we're going to see a couple of truths this morning. And one is this: though marriage is arranged in heaven, it will encounter difficulties, which difficulties God uses to mature the relationship. And secondly, surprisingly perhaps, the best part of marriage can come after our worst problems in marriage. And we're going to take this from the Song of Solomon, and why that book. Did you know that the Song of Solomon is the only book in Scripture that is devoted exclusively to a romantic relationship between a man and a woman? Here we find God's ideal in marriage. And I want to give you just a brief introduction to the Song of Solomon, and I hope that you can see this. When the book is written, Solomon is in his late 20s or early 30s. He is the king in training, preparing to be Israel's third king. But his dad, King David, is very concerned for Solomon. Why? Solomon was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He lives in the lap of luxury. He's waited on by servants. He has never held a job. He's never got his hands dirty with work. He has no sense of responsibility. David remembers as a young man, being a shepherd of sheep was very good training to become the shepherd, the king of God's people. So after Solomon's junior year at the University of Jerusalem, David purchases him a flock of sheep, sends him from Judea in the south to Galilee in the north for his summer internship. Did you know that in colleges and universities today, internships are very popular? It's where a student gets some hands-on practical training in what they hope to do with the rest of their life. This past week, I talked to one of our lady students at Moody. She's going to spend this summer in Africa doing her internship. It's required to graduate. She wants to be a missionary. She's going to Africa to live with missionaries, and they're going to train her and put her to work there on the mission field. So David sends his boy up to the rural area of Galilee to spend the summer doing what David did as a young man, watching sheep, taking care of them, in preparation for him becoming the king someday of Israel. And how do you suppose Solomon feels about going to the country of Galilee to keep smelly, dirty sheep? He doesn't like it one bit. He is as bored as he can be. He misses the exciting nightlife, the bright lights in the city of Jerusalem. He is bored until one day into his life walks the most gorgeous creature he has ever met. The book calls her the Shulamite. She is a rustic farm girl from the country. Her father is dead. She lives with her mother, her half-brothers. Her family makes her work outside taking care of the family vineyards. And he is so struck with her, he can hardly engage her in a conversation. He's nervous, but he forces himself to start a conversation with her. It's delightful. And in chapter 1, they meet and their relationship begins to take off. And here is, there are 8 chapters in the Song of Solomon. And here is basically the flow of thought. In chapter 1, this couple meet each other and they begin their friendship, their courtship. At the end of chapter 2, they're engaged. At the end of chapter 3, they're married. And chapter 4, they spend their first night together following their wedding. Their first night as husband and wife. Then there are some years that intervene between chapter 4 and chapter 5. And in chapter 5, their marriage is on the rocks. Things are so bad, chapter 6, they undergo what we would call a marital separation. Chapter 7, they reconcile. And then in chapter 8, they get their marital legs back under them. They go on a second honeymoon. And in chapter 8, their marriage is renewed and strengthened. Now, what I want us to do is I want us this morning to move quickly through all 8 chapters. We want to trace the story of their marriage. And to help us do this, we can't possibly take all verses in all 8 chapters. So I have selected key verses and put them on this handout that will enable us to trace the flow of thought through the Song of Solomon. So if you don't have this handout now, you will be utterly lost this morning in the sermon. So if you need this handout, will you raise your hand? And an usher will be glad to bring one to you. Is anybody without this handout? All right, we have one hand up here, Myron. All right, thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay. And as we move through this, we're going to notice a number of truths and principles about marriage. And I want to begin in chapter 1. I'm on the front of your handout. Chapter 1 and verse 2. In the very first verse, Solomon's girlfriend says, now, when chapter 1 opens, they have been spending some time together. We would say their boyfriend and girlfriend. And she says in chapter 1 and verse 2, oh, that he might kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. She wants to be kissed. Why? Second line, for the tokens of your love are more precious than your wealth. Now, she knows who Solomon is, that he is going to be Israel's next king. She knows he's going to be fabulously wealthy. And what she's saying here, your affection to me means far more than all that money and wealth that you are going to have. And so the first principle that we see here, fellows, is a woman needs constant evidences of her man's love for her. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Just said it right down there. I might need that. Appreciate that. What kind of token does she request? A kiss. And there are other kinds of tokens that we men can give the woman in her life. Not only a kiss, but maybe a pat on the hand, an arm around the shoulder, a hug, a kind word of appreciation, cheerful note that we leave her that we know she'll find, helpful hand with the housework, take her out for dinner, affirming her, etc., etc. Men, I can't tell you how important it is that the woman in her life receives constant evidences of our affection, that we esteem and cherish her. Now, this prudent woman states in the next verse, verse 4, she tells Solomon, draw me after yourself, meaning what? I am not going to chase you. You must take the initiative and come after me. Ladies, do not ever be aggressive with a man and pursue him. Remember, God has made men to be hunters, and God has put within us the spirit of taking the initiative. In fact, that's our second principle. A man should take the initiative in romance and pursue the woman. So she says, draw me after yourself, and we will run together. What does she mean, we will run together? If you take the initiative and come after me, our relationship has a chance of taking off, getting off the ground and going somewhere. I like to tell the young ladies at Moody this. Convey to a man that you were not easily had. Now, I'm not saying by that play hard to get like worldly women. But what I mean is convey to a man, I cannot get into a relationship with you without divine consent. Laura was one of my students from California. And she told me one day, in my classes, Richard, a wonderful fellow from Indiana, I am so impressed with him that for some time I've been observing him and praying about him. The other day, Richard shocked me and he said, Laura, I've been observing you for some time. I've grown so interested in you, I've started to pray about you. And she said, I couldn't believe my ears. He was doing the same two things that I had been doing, observing and praying about me. And Richard said, would you be open to becoming my girlfriend? Laura is wise. And she said, I don't know. Give me 2 weeks to pray about it. And Richard told me later, oh, that was so hard. I laid my heart out, wanted her to be my girlfriend. What was her answer? Give me 2 weeks to pray about it. So at the end of the 2 weeks, he said, do you have an answer? No, I need another 2 weeks to pray about it. He said, that was even harder. At the end of the second 2 weeks, Richard asked, do you have an answer for me? Are you willing to be my girlfriend? She's wise. And she says, I'm not ready to be your girlfriend. I am willing to get into a special relationship with you, to spend time with you, to see if God might want us to move it up to the next level. And that's what they did. She conveyed to him that she wasn't easily had. Now, in chapter 1 and verse 6, the third verse on your handout, she senses some of Solomon's friends despise her. So she tells them, don't look down on me because I am dark-complected, for the sun is tanned to me. Now, in our society, not a few people like having a suntan. But in ancient Israel, it was the other way around. People there are already dark-skinned. This girl is especially dark-skinned. And so in ancient Israel, they preferred what we are, light-complected. Why? Most people are dark-complected. And she senses some of Solomon's friends are looking down on her because she's especially dark-complected. Why? The sun has tanned me. My half-brothers were angry with me, and they appointed me keeper of the vineyards. But my own personal appearance, I have not kept up. I had a girl at Moody that was unusually tanned by the sun. She comes from South Dakota. And she told me during the summer her father had her work out in the pasture with the cows and the livestock, summer after summer. So she was just deeply dark-complected, even though she was a white Caucasian. And that's the situation with this girl. Now, in verse 15, the next verse, Solomon senses her sense of inferiority. So he says to her, you are beautiful, my companion. I am just struck with your outer looks. But he sees more to her than just outward good looks. And he says in the last half of verse 15, your eyes are like those of doves. You know what the eyes of a dove are like? Peaceful. Purity. And so our third principle is we need to be attracted to our spouse's outer and inner beauty. Now, in chapter 2 and verse 1, his words have an effect on her. And she says, I am a rose of Sharon. I am a lily of the valley. So what does she mean by that? I am one of many pretty women in the world. And so what we see here is our praise, our affirmation can build up our spouse's self-esteem. But notice in chapter 2 and verse 2, Solomon responds and tells her, you're only half right when you say you are one of many pretty women in the world. As a lily is among thorns, so is my companion among young women. What's he mean by that? As attractive and beautiful as other women are in the world, they are like thorns in comparison to you. And in chapter 2 and verse 3, she responds, as the apple tree among the trees of a forest. Now let's stop right there. In ancient Israel, the apple tree was the most highly prized tree. Why? Its refreshing shade, delightful fragrance, delicious fruit. So as the apple tree is among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among young men. All other young men, as handsome and strong as they are like common, ordinary trees. You, Solomon, are like an apple tree. In his shade, in his company, I sit with great delight. She enjoys time with him. And his fruit, kind words, thoughtful actions. His fruit, remember she's describing him like an apple tree, is sweet to my taste. So our fifth principle is, a couple's time together should not only be enjoyable, it ought to be profitable. Now, 1 Thessalonians 5 says, edify one another. What's edify mean? Build up. The word edified in Greek means to, it's used of a house being built up. The house hasn't reached completion, but it's on the way, being built up. It's on the way to reaching completion. And the New Testament takes that term and applies it to us morally. We Christians are to build each other up. Fortunately, we can contribute to one another becoming more and more the Christian God would have us be. And so I urge students at Moody, when they're dating and engaged and married, you guys edify, build each other up. Every couple has the potential of building each other up. Here's what most couples do. They tear each other down. They inflict wounds and scars on each other. And when their relationship comes apart and they go their separate ways, they're worse off for having been in a relationship. But suppose a couple for 50 or 60 years builds each other up. Look what an incredible couple they will become. And so I urge the students at Moody, be wise. Build each other up. Contribute to each other intellectually, socially. Sharpen each other's social manners and graces. Intellectually, socially, emotionally, don't leave each other in emotional shatters, spiritually and morally. Now, in verse 6, this godly woman admits something. I wish his left hand were under my head. I wish his right hand would embrace me. Do you understand what she's saying here? She's conceiving of her and her boyfriend lying down in bed and him embracing and touching her. What is she saying? I love this man so much. I wish we could go further physically in expressing our affection for one another. I wish we could go further than what we do. To be blunt about it, I wish we could get in bed and go all the way. What kind of woman is she? We know from the rest of the book, she is godly. But she is a normal woman. God has implanted sexual passion and desires, not just in us men, but in women as well. So she would like to go further. But notice her resolve in chapter 2 and verse 7. I make a vow to God not to arouse sexual love until the time is right. So our next principle is premarital sex destroys a relationship. So let's set, when we're dating, courting, engaged, let's set boundaries and limitations that govern how far we go in expressing our affection for one another. And may I suggest some boundaries? This is what I offer to the students at Moody. How far physically can a couple go who are not married? Not very far. They can hold hands. Let's stop right there. Now, for some people, that's not a whole lot. For other people, it is a whole lot. One girl at Moody told me the other night I held my boyfriend's hand for the first time and it was dynamite. So for some people, they're intoxicated holding the hand of their boyfriend or girlfriend. A couple can give each other a discreet, appropriate hug. They can kiss each other on the cheek if they have a permission with God, permission from each other. They're comfortable with it. They can give each other a light, brief kiss on the lips. Now, my question is, how could a couple go any further than this and it be okay with God? I don't understand. So I have a suggestion. Consider saving your kisses until the two of you are sure, reasonably sure, you're going to marry each other. Most couples don't do that. They kiss up a storm, break up, and go their separate ways. And why not limit your kisses to one life, brief kiss, a date? Why? Well, when Sue and I were dating, one night we were engaged in a deep, heavy, passionate kiss. We almost went too far. It was like the Holy Spirit tapped us on the shoulder and said, if you two don't slow down, you're headed toward trouble fast. And I said, Sue, we can't keep doing this. So let's limit our kisses to one light, brief kiss a date. We did that. We put that kiss off to the last part of our date. Boy, did we look forward to it. Boy, was it special. Boy, did it lower the temptation of going too far. So, yes, she'd like to go further, but absolutely she will not. She is going to save sex till marriage. Now, in chapter 2 and verse 15, she turns to another issue that can injure a relationship. Let us catch foxes, the little foxes that ruin our vineyards. In other words, what she's saying is, remember, her family makes her take care of the family vineyards. And foxes come in and out of the vineyard. I had to chase them off so they don't gnaw the vine and destroy the vines. And so Solomon, if you'll help me catch these foxes, I can spend more time with you. If you don't help me, then I've got less time to spend with you. But scholars see, and I believe they're right, something beyond just catching real foxes. She goes on to say, let us catch foxes, the little foxes that ruin our vineyards, while our vineyards, now she's talking about their relationship. While our vineyards are in bloom, while our relationship is growing healthy. In other words, Solomon, problems are coming up in our relationship and we need to deal with them. We need to nip them in the bud. So nip problems in the bud lest they grow worse. That's common sense. But not every couple does that. Couples sometimes allow problems in their relationship to stay, to fester, to get worse. Now in chapter 3 and verse 1, she has a recurring dream. On my bed, night by night, I sought him whom I dearly love. They're engaged at this point. I sought him but did not find him. Now she's having what scholars call a fear fulfillment dream. She has a recurring nightmare night after night that she doesn't know where her fiancé is. I sought him but did not find him. She is concerned about losing her fiancé. And sometimes that happens. Some engagements never result in marriage. One person loses interest in the other and breaks up. Another becomes more interested in somebody else and breaks up. Or maybe a fiancé dies. Some years ago, I had a girl from Iowa who was engaged. And when summer came, she went to Iowa to prepare her wedding. And about 4 or 5 days before the wedding, without any warning, her fiancé dropped dead. And on the day that they had planned their wedding, they held his funeral. And with her hand on his casket, she sang at his funeral the song that she was going to sing, planned to sing at their wedding. So here, Solomon's fiancé fears that she may lose him. And so what we have to do is hold your loved one in an open palm to God. What do I mean by that? This right here. This pen represents Sue. God, thank you so much for bringing Sue into my life and giving me a relationship, for giving me the privilege of being married to her. I will not grasp Sue and make an idol out of her and say I'm going to hold on to her. She is the most important priority in my life. I hold her in an open palm. And you can leave her there for as long as you wish. And God, I hope that is for the rest of my life. But Lord, at any point, you are free to reach down and remove Sue and take her. I've almost lost Sue twice in childbirth. 3 years ago, she had breast cancer. This week, she may get hit and killed by a drunk driver. We must hold our spouse, our children in an open palm. Why? They are on temporary loan. And here she fears that she may lose her fiancé. Verse 4, eventually I found him. I grasp him. Now, remember, she's in a dream. I found him. I grasp him and would not let him go. Now, in the last line of verse 4, she's talking like a little girl. Until I brought him into the bedroom of my mother who conceived me. What is she talking about? To a little child, where is the safest place in the world? To a little child. In the bedroom, in bed between dad and mama. Probably as little children, we all got scared in the night and ran and jumped in bed and got between dad and mom. That was like Fort Knox, the safest place in the world. Some years ago when our son Jeffrey was 5 years old, I woke up at 2 a.m. to go to the restroom, bathroom, and I walked out of our bedroom and there, standing just like that, like a statue, was our son Jeffrey, dressed in his Batman pajamas. And he startled me. I didn't expect to see Batman at 2 a.m. in the morning. And so when I walked out of the bedroom, headed toward the bathroom, Jeffrey was standing there like that. And I said, Jeff, he scared me. What are you doing here, son? It's dark in my bedroom. I'm scared. And I want Dad, I was just wondering if I could go see Mama. What's the problem? It's dark in my bedroom and I'm scared. Oh, Jeff, you don't need to be scared. The Lord's in there with you. I know, but I still need Mama. And I said, sure, go ahead. So he went and jumped in bed with Mama. Now he was safe. And so here in her dream, she finds her boy, her fiancé. She wants to take him like a little girl to the safest place in the world. And that is her mother's bedroom where he will be safe. Now in chapter 3 and verse 11, the next verse, they're married. Come, O citizens, and look with interest at King Solomon on his wedding day. And in chapter 4 and verse 12, they spend their wedding night together. And then he says to her, a locked garden is my bride. Now, what does he mean by that? As a private garden is off limits to the public, and the public has no right to enjoy, eat its produce. So my wife has been off limits sexually to all other men. Your spouse will greatly appreciate your moral, your sexual purity. The Bible urges us to save ourselves sexually before marriage for our spouse, and save ourselves sexually outside of marriage just for our spouse inside of marriage. But now, in chapter 4, on their wedding night, she's no longer off limits to her husband. And so she says in verse 16, she's speaking to him, rouse yourself, north wind, come south wind, blow upon my garden that its fragrance may waft about. Let my beloved come into his garden and enjoy its excellent fruits. What is she saying to Solomon? God has turned our red light green. Now we are free to enjoy each other physically and sexually. And what's the Bible teaching us here? That sex is a wonderful gift from God to be enjoyed only with the right person. Only at the right time. Who's the right person? Our divinely provided spouse. When's the right time? Only within the boundaries of marriage. And in chapter 5 and verse 1, it's the morning after. And Solomon speaks in the initial line of verse 1. I have come into my garden, my bride, and I've eaten my honeycomb. What's he saying? Last night, for the first time, she and I engaged in sex together, and it was wonderful. Now look at the last line in chapter 5 and verse 1. Here's the only time in the whole book that God himself speaks. And what does God say? Eat, O friends, and drink and become intoxicated with love, O lovers. What does God mean? I know what you all did last night. You had sex with each other. I put my full stamp of approval on it. Don't stop there. I want you two to continue to enjoy each other physically, sexually, for the rest of your married life. Now, as I mentioned earlier, between chapters 4 and 5, years of marriage have elapsed. And something troubles Mrs. Solomon. Chapter 5 and verse 2. I was asleep, but my mind was wide awake. Her burdened heart troubles her sleep. And what's the problem? Second line, she's quoting her husband. Please open to me my companion, my dove, my perfect one. He's been away on business. For my head is filled with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. So he's home from a business trip. And in chapter 5 and verse 3, she responds, I have taken off my tunic. How can I dress again? I have already washed my feet. How can I soil them again? What is she saying here? Husband, why don't you just drop dead, and blow away? She has lost all interest and affection for her husband. And often that happens in marriage. One, spouse can lose interest and love for the other. It happened here, though this marriage was arranged by God in heaven. In chapter 5 and verse 6, she eventually gets up. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had gone. He had vanished. She waited too late. My soul yearned for him to speak. I sought him, but did not find him. And scholars tell us that they are now maritally separated. They are no longer living together. So our principle here is problems are part of every romantic relationship. So don't be unduly discouraged when problems arise. Now in chapter 5 and verse 9, some of her friends ask, what is your beloved more than other beloveds, O most beautiful among women? What do you see in your husband? And in verse 10, she answers, my beloved is fair-complected and ruddy. He is the most distinguished among 10,000 noble men. He has his faults, his weaknesses. But when I think about it, he's really a good man. In fact, I think he's head and shoulders above other men that I'm aware of. The principle here is, focus on your spouse's virtues, not on your spouse's flaws and weaknesses. Folks, here's one of the biggest mistakes married people make. The squeaking wheel gets the grease. If we focus on our spouse's weaknesses, mistakes, flaws, we can become bitter, ungrateful for that person. I need to remember, okay, my wife's got feet of clay. She's not going to do everything right. But I need to focus on those virtues that are attracted to me to Sue in the first place. And that's what she's doing here. Now, her friends in chapter 6 and verse 1 offer help to assist them to reconcile. Where did your beloved go? Where did your beloved turn away that we may seek him with you? When necessary, get outside help with your relationship. Try and keep your car running well. But if your car has a problem you can't fix, take it to a mechanic. Try and maintain good oral hygiene. But when there's a problem with your tooth you can't fix, go to somebody who can fix it, your dentist, etc. Try and maintain a good, happy marriage. But when there are problems that are beyond you and your spouse fixing, go to a third party who can help you. And that's why they say, where did your beloved go? Where did your beloved turn away that we can seek him with you? In chapter 6 and verse 2, she responds, my beloved went down to his garden to gather lilies. We know from the book of Kings that gardening was one of Solomon's favorite hobbies. She knew where she was likely to find him. And so in chapter 6 and verse 4, Mrs. Solomon and her friends go there to meet Solomon. And he greets her in verse 4, you are beautiful, my companion, like Tirzah. Tirzah was a lovely little town in Israel. You are beautiful, my companion, like Tirzah, and lovely as Jerusalem. He compares her to Israel's two most gorgeous cities. You are awesome as an army with banners. Our 14th principle here is forgiveness paves the path for reconciliation. A couple weeks ago, a couple from Champaign, Urbana came up to spend the day with me and Sue. They're separated maritally. And toward the end of our discussion, the husband said to about his wife, she must forgive me, not so much for what I've done, but for what I haven't done. What do you mean by that? He's been so passive in marriage. He just brings on the paycheck, period. He won't help his wife raise the kids, discipline the kids, clean house, nothing. Passive, passive, passive. And the wife's been very bitter at her husband for being a do-nothing husband. And he was right. She needs to forgive me for what I haven't done. Forgiveness is necessary so we can get back together and work on our marriage. And Solomon here offers forgiveness. Remember, it was his wife who lost interest in feeling for her, and he forgives her for that. Now, his praise affects her in 6:12. She speaks and says, before I knew it, I was enraptured with, not his criticism, with his praise. And Solomon set me in his own chariot. So Solomon puts Mrs. Solomon in his chariot, and they now start riding through the streets of Jerusalem to let people know, who the people know they've been separated, to let people know we're back together now, living together as husband and wife. And in chapter 6 and verse 13, the citizens watch him go past down the streets of Jerusalem in his chariot. And they shout out, return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may gaze upon you. The principle here is factor God into marriage. Factor God into marriage. Reconciliation and healing are possible. And not only that, people delight being around a couple in love with each other. Let me go back to this right here. Factor got into marriage. That couple from Champaign, Urbana, the wife was so downcast and hopeless that God could change her husband that I told her, you know, you're speaking, you're responding just like a woman of the world. You're acting as though God doesn't exist, that he can't change your husband. You have a repentant husband. You have a husband who's willing to change. I want you to factor God into it. God can change your husband. He can heal your marriage. You can have what you've wanted, a happy marriage. But you're going to need the Lord to be a part of it. Now, in chapter 7 and verse 11, she makes a suggestion to her husband. Come, my beloved, let's go to the field. Let's lodge in the villages. You and I have been through a difficult time in marriage. We're back together again. Let's take a second honeymoon. Let's leave all the busyness of the palace down in Judea and go north to my neck of the woods where we met each other. Let's have a second honeymoon. Let's get our marital legs back under us. And how does this woman feel about her husband? Well, notice her change of heart in chapter 8 and verse 1. I wish you were like a brother to me. Why? If I met you outside, I would kiss you. Then people would not despise me. What does she mean by that? I love you so much. I'd like to just, I don't want to wait until we're in private to hug and kiss you. I love you so much, I'd like to hug and kiss you out in public. Back in ancient Israel, pretty much like today, it's more socially acceptable for you to hug and kiss a brother or sister than to hug or kiss out in public a boyfriend, a fiance, or a spouse. I love you so much, I wish I could hug and kiss you out in public like I could my brother, and people wouldn't despise me. Now, in chapter 8 and verse 5, they're standing under a special tree. And Solomon reminds her, under this apple tree, I arouse your love. And when we were recording, it was under this tree for the first time we recognized our love for one another. And then he says, as they're standing under this tree, he's now pointing to his mother-in-law's house where his wife was born. There, in that house, your mother was in travail with you. In labor, there she gave you birth. You know what he's doing? He is setting side by side the apple tree where they first discovered they were in love with each other with his mother-in-law's house, where his mother-in-law went through pain in giving birth to his wife. Now listen to this. Why the placing side by side the apple tree where they first realized their love with one another, for one another, and the place where his wife was born? As the labor pain and travail brought forth her birth, so similarly there was some pain in the travail of romantic love. But what pain is there in romance? Perhaps the pain of having to break off a previous relationship and the pain of informing your beloved of that previous relationship that may have been wrong. In romance, there's also the pain of unworthiness that comes upon a person in realizing that he does not deserve the person whose heart he now possesses. There's also the pain of periodic separations, the pain of fearing that the one loved may be lost or taken from you. There may be the pain of fearing what may happen or where this love may lead, or the anxiety of possibly being hurt in a close relationship, or the necessity of having to give up something in order to love, or the hurt involved in bearing the flaws and offenses of your beloved, the pain arising from quarrels and misunderstandings, the difficulties associated with working through problems together. There is pain in romance. But as pain in childbirth leads to something wonderful, namely a baby, so pain in romance can lead to a deeper understanding and more meaningful affection for one another. If handled correctly, romantic travail can issue in a more mature love than previously experienced. The end result is more than worth the pain. Romantic pain is forgotten when love matures, just as a mother forgets the pain of childbirth when holding her baby in her arms. So what's the principle here? Romantic love is painful. Some time ago, a student said out loud in a class, all the other students heard him. I'm glad he said it out loud. He said this, I want a girlfriend, but I'm not going to try and get one because I don't want to hurt her and I don't want her to hurt me. And I said, that is so idealistic. Let's set idealism aside and be realistic. If you go swimming, you're going to get wet. You play football, you're going to get hit. When you get into a romantic relationship with a member of the opposite sex, you're going to step on her toes. She's going to step on your toes. There's pain in romance. Is that bad? Let's think about you and Jesus. He demands that you die to self, spurn the world, pick up your cross daily and follow him. Someday Christ may ask you to lay down your life for him. There's real pain in your relationship with Christ. Is that bad? No, indeed. God uses that pain in our relationship with Christ to break us and refine us and make us more godly people. Now go back to romance. There's pain there. Is that bad? No. Just don't deliberately hurt the other person. There's enough pain in romance when it's unintentional. Respond to the pain in romance and let God use it to break and refine us. In verse 6, she tells Solomon, make me as the signet ring over your heart, as the signet ring on your finger. For strong as death is love, and unyielding as the grave is passionate love. Its flames are the flames of a mighty fire. What is she saying here? That romantic love is rightly possessive. And in verse 7, she continues, many, numerous, severe problems cannot quench love. What does she mean by that? Romantic love is permanent. You sometimes hear a person say, well, I don't love my wife anymore. I don't love her like I used to. That wasn't real love. Real love lasts. And she ends verse 7 by saying, were a man to give all his wealth for love, he would be utterly despised. Romantic love is priceless. It cannot be bought or purchased. It must be freely given. And notice how this book ends in chapter 8, verse 13. He speaks to his wife. Oh, you who sit in the gardens, your friends are giving attention to your voice. Your friends, your girlfriends want time with you. Let me hear your voice. I want time with you as well. Regular, meaningful time for a man and woman together is essential. Let me put it this way. This is common sense. In order for a relationship to begin between a man and a woman, they must spend time together. Think about it. Would you have ever married your spouse if the two of you hadn't spent time together? Of course not. So for a relationship to begin between a man and a woman, they must spend time together. Now let's take it a step further. In order for that relationship to deepen, mature, and grow, that husband and wife must continue to spend meaningful time together. We have to be careful about living under the same roof. We can live under the same roof, sleep in the same bed, be together, and yet in one sense not be together. I watch TV all the time. Sue's on the computer all the time. We talk on the phone to other people. We're together, but we don't spend any meaningful time together. And when a husband and wife don't spend any meaningful time together, here's what happens. They begin to drift emotionally from each other. So what are we seeing here? Though a marriage is arranged in heaven, it will encounter difficulties. Your marriage is not going to be free of trouble any more than mine has. But God can use those difficulties, if we respond rightly to them, to mature and deepen our marriage. And lastly, the best part of marriage can come after our worst marriage problems. So, Father, we thank you for this unique relationship that you have established called marriage. You, of all people, are very aware of the challenges in it. And we ask that you give us grace to not be discouraged by problems when they surface in our marriages, but may we respond rightly to them and see you use them to deepen our relationship as husband and wife with each other. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. We now come to a very special part of our service. This is not a postscript.